Hello and welcome to Robot Dice Explosion podcast. I'm Ben.
I'm Ollie.
It's Tuesday the 17th of July when we're recording this. Probably doesn't matter because we don't talk about the news an awful lot. But
I don't think there's going to be much news in this, but...
Yeah, who knows? They say it on other podcasts, so, you know, I'm trying to be professional.
Seems like a good start to it then.
Yeah. Should always explain
yes.
Right at the beginning of the podcast what you did. So, what have you been up to?
Less than you'd think based on our last let's catch up on games episode.
Yeah, I've barely played a game since we last spoke.
I'm trying to remember, I think I might have played a game of Guild Ball, maybe. No, that's probably in the last episode. I've played board games.
I've skipped the last 2 weeks at the club.
Yes.
We're now like 3 weeks out from the due date of our first child.
Yeah.
So
you're a little bit busy.
A little bit busy and just a little bit sort of drained from wanting to go to the club, really. Like, you know, we've had jobs to do around the house.
Yeah.
Everything's pretty much in place, but I've just sort of... I don't know what it is. So I haven't been playing many games. A couple of weeks ago, though, I did go to the club and played Arena Rex. And I think you were playing Guild Ball when I was playing Arena Rex.
No.
No?
Played something... We played a board game or something.
Oh, you and Paul played a board game. I can't even remember what it was, though.
Role player.
Oh, okay.
Where you make a D&D character. It's a dice game. You roll dice. Each character have, like, oh, you're this race and you're this class and stuff. You want... your strength needs to be in this band and so on and so forth. You want a disalignment. You have different color dices. Your strength needs a green in... Precision 3 and various abilities and that, and you can go and fight monsters and stuff. It's quite fun, actually.
Okay.
I have played something, just forgotten, for some reason. I played Battletech last week.
Oh, yeah, of course you did. That was you and Paul again, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Paul has an extensive collection of Battletech, doesn't he?
All of the Battletech.
Yeah.
I don't actually think it's all of it. He has a lot of Inner Sphere stuff.
It's something that goes back a long way, isn't it, Battletech?
Yeah, we had people come over and like, oh, Battletech! Are you two regular players? And I was like, oh, no, like, probably 15 years since I played that. No, 20.
So some people might not know what Battletech is. I mean, I barely know, but...
Yeah.
I mean, it's a mech game, but it's old
it's
school.
It's the mech game.
Yeah.
Really?
It goes back...
Early 80s?
Yeah.
It's basically as old as I am.
There's some interesting stuff around, like... Mech Warrior, Battletech, Robotech, they're all sort of, in my mind, intertwined.
So Mech Warrior and Battletech are the same thing.
Right, okay.
Mech Warrior is a line of computer games set in Battletech.
Ah.
And the role-playing game was also called Mech Warrior, I believe.
Okay, and so the PC game that's been out for a few months now...
It's called Battletech.
That's Battletech.
Yes.
So these are all the same... IP.
Yes. So the difference between the MechWarrior games and Battletech, because there's a MechWarrior game coming out next year as well, it's been postponed, so it's coming out next year.
Okay.
Is that Battletech, you are controlling a whole lance. It's basically like the miniature game. So you click on a mech and then you move it around and you shoot and stuff. Whereas the MechWarrior games have been, as far as I know, all of them have been more first-person shooters.
Yeah, you're like a pilot.
Yeah.
I certainly remember that early days of 3D games on the PC, you know, where you're looking is independent from where you're moving.
Yes.
I'm finding that quite a difficult thing for my motor skills back then. It was a whole, you know, coming from consoles.
Yeah.
So it was quite difficult.
Quite an important concept in the game as well, the torso twist and stuff.
But
and then we played... The classical version? There's two versions of the miniature game now.
Okay.
There's Classic Battletech, I think it's called. Might be wrong. And Alpha Strike, which is a super simplified version.
Because that's to allow bigger games, isn't it?
Yeah, because the issue... Like, me and Paul played a lance each, so 4 mechs. I think it was a light, 2 mediums, and a heavy.
Okay.
We played for like 3 hours and destroyed 3 mechs.
Yeah.
Of course... It's also with us not having played.
Yeah, I was going to say, it doesn't seem unreasonable to be playing a game for the first time in 15 years, which may as well be your first time playing it, and over the course of 3 to 4 hours, not quite finished.
Yeah.
There were
quite a lot of mechs who were on very low damage capacity.
Yeah.
So that was fine, but it has always had slight issues with time and bookkeeping.
Yeah.
As in, there's a lot of it.
I mean, So you, Paul and I were talking about it briefly the other day, and it seems that largely a lot of the time sync is actually setting up your Lance of mechs, because you need to make sure you've got all the right sheets there.
Yeah, so that can be a bunch of that. So each mech has a battle value, and I think there's multiple... There's two different systems for that, because there was an original one and then there's a new one and stuff, and you sort of want them roughly equivalent. Because a mech of a given weight class is not the same as another mech of the same weight class, because some of them are drastically better than others.
Yeah, I've heard that. I mean, I've definitely, because I listened to a few podcasts about video games, and with the BattleTech game, people talking about how light mechs are basically crap.
Light mechs are, oh, that's a cute mech, let me one-shot it for you.
Yeah, I mean, it seems that the, because they're quite often armed with machine guns, and the video game has made a change to
machine
the
guns are better.
Where the machine guns, if your armor's gone, machine guns are just horrible, because they're just shredding your exposed wiring and all that sort of stuff.
The internal systems, yeah.
Yeah, so that sort of makes them the tiniest bit more relevant.
Yeah.
But the trouble is they will just get one-shotted by medium or assault, whatever you call it.
Yeah, you've got light, medium, heavy, and assault. So assault's like the 85 ton plus.
Okay.
I
guess that's the top of the scale.
It stops at 100 tons.
Okay.
So, I mean, at the moment, the Lance I'm using... Because I'm also playing the computer game. At the moment, I'm using 4 salt mechs, which output a lot of damage. I've also, because assault mechs are slow, so all of them have jump jets, so they can all fly.
Okay.
I mean, fly.
And then you have your
rocket. Rocket jump, basically, but which has helped a lot, so they're not actually that slow.
So with the miniatures game, I'm assuming it's gone through a couple of additions over the years.
Yes.
Does it still feel...
Hasn't old. Changed very much.
So it does feel like an old game.
I mean, the way it works is you do your movement, and so you can either be stationary, you can walk, or you can run. And that'll inflict a hit modifier on you.
Okay, yeah.
Based on the amount of squares you physically move, that'll inflict a hit modifier on your opponent. Because doing things like walking into forest costs additional movement. So, walking on an open tile costs one space, as you'd imagine. And, like, a mech might move five squares. Well, hexes. Five hexes. Mm-hmm. So, I can walk five hexes. That's fine. But if I want to do anything other than walk straight ahead on open ground, it starts costing additional things. Because turning, like, facing another... Each facing you change costs a movement as well.
Okay.
Moving up costs extra, moving into cover costs extra, and so on and so forth. So it's not how many movement points you spent, it's how much did you physically move that matters. That inflicts a hit modifier on your opponent.
Okay, so if you moved three squares and you turned facing twice...
Yeah, I would only count as moving
like
three.
Minus three to them.
Actually, in this case, I think it would be minus nothing, because I think you need to move four for it to count. But it's in bands, so it's, I think it's something like 0 to 3, 4 to 5, 6 to 9, something like that. I can't remember them all. But it's something like that. So that way. You take turns moving.
Mm-hmm. Also, it's I do one thing, you do one thing.
But you don't shoot yet.
Okay.
Once everyone has moved, or at least this was the way... I assume this is the rules. I just let Paul run the game because I hadn't read the rule book. once you've done that, everyone then shoots. And shooting is simultaneous.
Okay, so you don't remove a mech before it has shot?
No.
If it gets removed at all. Okay, I like that.
So you go, like, okay, we've now done all our positioning. And then you just go like, okay, well, I'll start with this one. I think you declare all of you shooting, maybe? I don't know. I can't remember. I didn't really do that, but it also didn't really matter. It was fairly obvious what all of my mechs were going to do most of the time. So, yeah.
Sure.
And then you roll. It's a 2d6 system.
Okay.
So you do... I think it's 12 minus... You have to roll equal to your gunnery skill or higher.
Okay.
So all of the modifiers add to your gunnery skill. So you start with a gunnery skill of 3, but you have... Oh, okay. Well, your opponent moves, so that's plus 3, and he's in cover, so that's plus 2, and you walk, so that's another plus 1. Suddenly you need to roll 9 or more.
Okay. Sure. So there's lots of modifiers on generally a single roll, what, per weapon?
Yes, you roll per weapon.
Okay.
And so...
But it'd be even like, if your gun has one shot, then it's your two dice. If it's got four shots, it's still two dice.
Still two dice per shot.
Right, okay.
So that varies a little bit. It depends a little bit on what type of gun it is, because you also have a cluster method. So, for instance, you use a missile launcher, like long-range missiles, 20. So you're shooting 20 missiles. You only roll one hit. But then there's a chart for how many missiles actually hit.
Okay.
So this is where, like, each shot, like, once you know all of the charts, it'll massively speed up.
Yeah.
Because you roll your to hit. That's fine. You've hit. Okay, cool. Right, where are you hitting? So it's a hit location chart, which is different based on are you at the front or the rear, or the left and the right. Yeah. And then you roll 2d6 to find out, oh, what did you hit? Cool. If it is a cluster weapon, you then need to assign clusters of 5 points of damage per cluster until you are down to the last one, which can be any regular number.
Right.
So if you do 17 points of damage with the cluster weapon, you roll the first 3 locations are 5 points each, and then there's a 2 points to allocate at the end. You then mark them off on your sheet. And then, we're not necessarily done. If you've done internal damage, you see if you make a critical hit.
Okay, so, yeah, there's a lot to roll and figure out.
Because then there's also like, oh, you made a critical hit. Okay, cool. What did you hit?
Yeah.
So there is just a lot of dice rolling to resolve shots.
Okay.
Which is why it takes a while.
Yeah.
Which is why in tournament play, you play with 2 mechs.
Yeah, that's interesting. I the thing that's attractive about the idea of mech combat is that granularity.
Yes.
But the thing that's unattractive is the logistics, how long it takes to do that.
Yes, exactly. So I'm not sure you can... I mean, Alpha Strike is mostly done away with, as far as I understand.
Hmm.
Like, you just have some cars, and there's a couple of points of damage on them and stuff, but it's much more like a more modern miniature game.
Hmm.
But I'm not sure if I'm playing Battletech, I'm not sure that's what I want.
No, sure. I mean, to a certain extent, it reminds me a little, maybe a little bit of Battlefleet Gothic with the chart. Are you moving alongside?
Yeah. Oh, yeah,
head-on or whatever.
Barrage chart?
Gunnery.
Gunnery, maybe. Yeah. Whatever it was called.
Sure. But also
I just used to fill space with lots of torpedoes.
Yes. also like Titan Legions, where you had the massive card with all the tokens on it.
Yeah, Imperator Titan, where you was like, okay, well, I'm allocating my power to the Plasma Annihilator and movement. And
I think it's really cool.
Yeah,
it's
not necessarily practical.
Like, no, and the trouble is, if you did jog it, then you'd be like, oh god. But the idea is
like Terraforming Mars, where you're like, oh, I got lots of the same color tokens. Do you need to stay in the same? Oh, I knocked it. It's probably like this.
But the idea of having a single model but managing its resources and stuff, that appeals to me at a certain level. I mean, I wonder if it's probably better off in video games, because then you've got something which is keeping track of everything. And obviously the nice thing about the Battletech video game is that it's doing all the roles for you.
Yes.
It just tells you what happened.
Yes.
So I can understand that sort of streamlines it.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder, you could probably do some clever app-based stuff.
Yeah, easy. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, well, I say easy. If you're tracking how many hexes you've moved and stuff like that, then you're going to have to input a bunch of stuff. By the time you've done that, you may as well have rolled.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I wonder if you could do, like... Did you ever try... James has it. Golem Arcanum?
Is that the thing with the pen?
Yes, it is. Yeah, you have a pen, and then you scan... Like, there's a scanner on the card you're moving, and then you can scan, and then you scan the hex it moves to and stuff. Mm. That actually works surprisingly well, except it doesn't work on modern phones, so it doesn't work anymore.
Well,
at least it didn't when I checked.
Yeah,
but you could do something like this.
There's probably another, there's a topic here, but with digital assistants for games, the worry that I have is that normally when I get down the club, it's the end of a working day.
Yeah.
I have to have, if I'm doing something like that with a phone, I need to have remembered to keep my phone charged.
Yeah.
There's not a charging point by every table at the club. You know, there are charging points, but whatever. You're not necessarily going to be next to one.
Power packs and dedicated game tablets.
Yeah, and then of course, you know.
But then you're like,
keeping them up to date. It's got to be a large company like Privateer Press or Fancy Flight.
Fancy Flight does lovely stuff, but they're also, comparatively speaking, massive.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not. In the grand scheme of things, that big.
Within this industry.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
So. Yeah, no, I really like BattleTech. I tried reading up on some of the story,
mm-hmm.
because obviously, as I said, like, I played it last, like, 20 years ago, which was in the middle of, oh, the clans are invading. Turns out a bunch of stuff has happened since then, and I was trying to read it, and I was like, this is confusing.
It seems like it's got a pretty rich background. And
that's masses of it.
Yeah, I understand that some of it can be a little problematic. Like, it has moved beyond the, hey, look, we've got Japanese in space, they're samurais, and it's a feudal system.
Yeah.
I mean, that's still sort of there from what I understand. But
the House Kurita has not changed. There is also House Lao, which are Chinese, I believe, or Korean. I think it's Chinese. I can't remember. My memories of it are a little bit... I mean, you basically have Japanese in space. You got Chinese in space. You got Germans in space.
It's all very 80s.
English in space. And they are some Nordic countries. Yeah, it's kind of like that. Well, it's because they've turned it into a feudal system.
Yeah.
But at some point, not today, we're going to talk about sci-fi and feudalism in space because it's a massive trope and it's basically how all sci-fi is done.
Yeah.
If you think about it, most sci-fi settings are effectively feudalism in space.
Yeah.
Because it's easy to do. It makes for great narratives as well, because you have a couple of people who are in charge. Yes. And can do stuff.
Or you have a dictatorship or whatever.
Mm.
So, a word to the wise. Check you've got enough space on your SD card before you start recording podcast.
Might be useful.
So I think we probably talked for half an hour to 45 minutes and got the first 15 minutes. Something like that, I reckon.
Yeah, something like that.
So we're now going to go over everything that we talked about again, if we can remember what it was.
Probably just shorter.
A little shorter, maybe. So,
which I'm sure everyone will appreciate, to be honest.
Well, we're already failing in that. Quickly, I think we'll talk about some miniature games that we talked about playing. So I have missed the club a couple of weeks, but I played Arena Rex,
yeah.
Which honestly is one of my favourite skirmish games. It's set in a low fantasy, gladiatorial setting.
Yeah.
3 to 5 models. They're resin, a little bit on the fragile side, beautifully sculpted by some of the best physical sculptors in the industry. But, yeah, expensive. There is a company over here where you can get them from. Works out, even with customs charges, is about the same as if you just order it from the States at $150 for free shipping. Which, honestly, you're going to spend $150. But you only need 3 to 5 models.
So, in theory, you would need to spend that much, but you might.
Yeah. I mean, I want to expand, and that's how much I'd spend, but I can't. So, it's a turnless game. Well, that's the idea. You go back and forth with activations. Every time you activate, the model gets a point of fatigue. If the if you activate a model, and you can only activate a model which doesn't have fatigue on it, you can remove 1 point of fatigue from any of your other models, which is a way of keeping the game rolling, but without you just going down on the same model repeatedly.
It works very nice. I like that, because you have to make choices. You can keep going with this. You can do multiple things with the same, but eventually
you can go all out on a single model, but
it creates problems later on.
Yeah.
On, like, for instance, Infinity, where you generate your orders, but you can then spend them on whoever you like. And you can do that every turn.
Yeah, so you can have an orders battery, essentially. But in this, you can't. And you can activate a model. Their first move is free, then they do an action. Or they could do another action after that, or another move. But that will cost you an extra fatigue. And at the end of your turn, you know, you'll have up to 2 fatigue on you. If you have 2 fatigue, you are exhausted. And that fatigue cannot be removed until you hit a clear turn. A clear turn is triggered when you have no models which can activate. So every model has at least 1 point of fatigue, or, you know, maybe they'll have 2 on them, which makes them exhausted. At that point, you remove 1 point of fatigue from everyone, and you get to do your faction abilities. You pay for them with favour, which is essentially how popular you are with the crowd. And yeah, I really like it. It's played on a 24-inch board. You can probably knock a game out in 30 to 45 minutes if you know what you're doing.
Yeah, but even if you I mean, the biggest problem with not, if you don't know what you're doing, is actually going to be to generate enough damage. Yeah. I think. Not to actually play the game, it's just you will not be as up on the combinations you need to do.
Yeah. You can also find that when you first introduce someone to it, it's quite easy to hit them over the head repeatedly because they'll overextend. Or the opposite, they'll be afraid of overextending and so therefore just not really do enough each time.
Yeah.
So there's this real sort of risk-reward balance that you have to get of, well, I need to exhaust a model here in order to really gain the advantage. But the trouble is, because they're exhausted, everyone gets a free push on them.
Yeah.
Oh, and manipulating your opponent's position
is important.
Super important in this game. There's hazards, and if you push someone into a hazard, then depending on what it is, like an obstacle, it will just make them gain a fatigue. If it's dangerous, it will cause damage to them. And you have lethal traps where if you push them into it, they are dead.
Yes.
Which there's one model which is basically like a wrestler who just loves throwing people, following up and then throwing them into a pit. Really interesting game. So I want to play more of that. It's just persuading people to drop the cash on it. For a game that maybe doesn't get played that much.
Don't own any of it at the moment. Yeah. I'm like, oh, I want to, but I have lots of other things to spend money on at the moment.
I own enough to play games of 3-on-3, and I've got some other models which I haven't properly put together or painted yet that I was kindly gifted. So I can definitely support someone else playing the game against me. Trouble is, it's usually within the same faction, which is fine, but you know, I'd like to see some more out there.
I mean, I have my eyes on some Romans.
Yeah.
Because you do lots of shenanigans with pushing.
Yes.
Which seems fun.
So the faction I have are the Zephyri, which are essentially Nordic or Germanic.
Germanic, I think.
But with Native Americans, which is an interesting mix.
Yeah, it's a bit weird.
Yeah. It works. I think it's fine. There are other factions, like there's an Egyptian faction, there's a Roman Legion faction, there's a Ludus faction, so a gladiatorial school. But you also get some fantastical stuff like Medusa.
Yeah, there's a range of effectively mercenary monsters, I think. Or can you run a list just with them?
So if there's an Egyptian character who is a Beastmaster, and he has his own pseudo-faction card, which basically means if you take him and a bunch of beasts, then that works as a faction.
Okay.
Which he's on my list to get, because I've got a bunch of beasts. That's a cool game. People should check that out. Very simple as well. I think the rules are available online for free, but might be just the tiniest bit out of date. I can't remember.
I mean, a lot of games these days will give you the rules for free, because that's not worth.
Yeah, I really think a lot of them should. If they're trying to sell miniatures, then they should. If they're not trying to sell miniatures and they're trying to sell a system, I can see the argument for charging people even just for a fiver for a PDF.
But you then also get into, then there's the other issue of like, well, if lots of stuff are free, are you going to start a rule set where you have to pay up front?
Yeah. I don't know. It's difficult. It's a hard sell. I played that a couple of weeks back. You played, I don't know if we've mentioned this before we lost the recording, but you played
Role Player.
I think you did mention that
before. I think I did.
Yeah.
If not, we'll probably come back to it at some other point. So
yeah,
it's fun. Works better with more players than two as well.
Yeah, sure. I think most games.
Most board games.
Yeah.
Miniature games, significantly less so.
Yeah, it's a lot harder to make them work with more than two players. So while I haven't really been playing miniature or board games very much, I have been playing some video games. I completed Shadow of the Colossus. Well, I completed the platinum on that. Seeing as I'm about to have a kid, I'm probably never going to platinum a game ever again. So I figured I'd do it on Shadow of the Colossus because it's pretty easy. You have to do about 5 playthroughs, but you can get those runs down to like 3 hours by the time that you get through to your third or fourth.
Yeah, it's not that unreasonable.
No. You get a sword from doing the time trials, which effectively wipes out a weak point in a single hit.
Which would be nifty.
A single fully charged stab, not just a little jab.
Yeah. But, I mean, I've borrowed it off you. I've done the first three.
Yeah.
And that would definitely be practical on some of them. I can see that.
Oh, yeah.
Because you're like, you charge it up and you stab him and you're like, oh, I need to do that multiple times. And he's now trying to get rid of me.
Yeah. Yeah. So you need to look into, you can increase your grip meter and you can increase your health by collecting stuff throughout the world.
Yes. I tried looking that up and I was like, that seems...
So you'll find big trees that they look very different from most of the other trees. And you'll find those throughout the world. They'll have fruit on them. So shoot the fruit down and pick that up. That'll get you health.
Okay.
And there's lizards throughout the world. And if some of them glow, like they have glowing tail, shoot them and pick up the tail and that will increase your grip meter.
So initially it certainly seems like grip is going to might be much more important to increase than your health.
Absolutely.
Because as long as you can stay on to the colossal, it's not really going to hurt you.
No, I mean the final boss will kill you in a single hit. Well, not a single hit, but he has a thing where he fires fireballs at you
if
he can see you. If the first one hits, when you get hit in Shadow of the Colossus, you stay down for a while.
Yeah.
Just as you start standing back up, he'll hit you again because he's a prick.
That seems unfortunate.
Yeah. It's at that point that I just click restart. But, so I completed that and moved on to The Last of Us Remaster, which is a pretty cool game. The stealth mechanics, they're all right. They're not always consistent. I'll talk about that in a minute. That's old playing another game that I'll talk about. They're not always consistent, the stealth mechanics, but it's a beautiful game. It is fun to play. I think the storyline so far is pretty compelling, the relationship between the two characters, and obviously this theme of like losing a child, which is pretty heavy, but...
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm enjoying that. But the main thing, actually, that I've done is finally got around this last weekend to drilling some holes in my walls and cabling in Ethernet to my computer and downstairs to my Steam Link, which I previously tried on Wi-Fi, which just was no good. The latency was a real bummer. And then I tried it through the power line connectors, which worked for a while, but then started having not latency issues, but every now and then it would just...
Not connect.
The video would pause, but you could still hear the audio and you could still move around.
Oh.
But there was still that latency problem. I tried playing Rocket League online and there was no way that you had... Your controls were not quick enough.
Yeah.
So I've cabled it in now. My wife and I are playing through the last two episodes of the first season of Life is Strange.
Yeah. Which is good.
Yeah, it is good. I think what they're trying to do with a narrative-led adventure game is really good. And I think their writing is well-intentioned, but doesn't always hit. It does just come across just a little bit cheesy a lot of the time.
I don't know if... It's also like partly just the story.
Yeah.
I think maybe.
And, you know, the main character can be a little bit insufferable at times. But, I think what they're trying to do with it is really good. And I think they'll get there with further games in the series. I'm just worried a little bit about it becoming too saccharine. Because they recently released a prequel to Life is Strange 2 called Captain Spirit, which is about this like young boy who has a difficult relationship with his father who's struggling with depression and alcohol, and the kid pretends to be this superhero called Captain Spirit. It just seems a little bit saccharine from the videos, but then I'll give it a go. It's free. There was the prequel to Life is Strange, which was done by a different company, and that was done during the voice actors strike. And therefore the main character, not the main character, Chloe, was voiced by someone different, which is a little bit weird, but I haven't played that and I probably won't. So we're playing through that, finishing it off. And I'm playing Rocket League again. When you turned up, I was playing a couple of games after lunch.
I want to get back to playing that. It's fun.
I love Rocket League.
I'm just not very good at it.
The first thing you need to grasp is the execution. Just managing to hit the ball is the first thing. But then,
surprisingly hard.
Yeah, surprisingly hard. And then you start getting like the odd aerial and things like that. You start feeling comfortable with the controls. You can look at videos of pros playing Rocket League and it's ridiculous. They may as well be flying.
It looks amazing.
Yeah. I will never get there. It requires a certain sort of combination of button presses with a spatial awareness that I don't think I'm going to get to.
It also requires just lots and lots of practice.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I've got 355 hours in the game over the last 3 years. So maybe not, you know, maybe that's not too hilarious. But I think
you're low.
Maybe. For someone who's had the game most of the way since release, maybe I am. I tend to play it sporadically. Every 3 months, I'll play it for a month. Sorry, 6 months, I'll play it for like a month.
Yeah.
Quite obsessively. And then I'll get a little tired of some of the toxic people in the community and I just sort of walk away.
Yeah, that's always a problem.
Online games, anonymity and sadly, angry kids. Well, I'd like to think they're kids. But what I find really cool about Rocket League is when you find that player who wants to play as a team.
Yes.
And he's not just chasing the ball constantly and ignoring what you're doing, therefore like hitting you out of the way when you're about to score, or hitting you out of the goal when you're about to defend it, because he's not paying attention.
Yeah, he's just looking at the ball and where he is.
But when you get that that player who's like, they'll go up and attack, and I'll sort of hang back around midway, and then when they go in for the shot, but maybe they miss it, they'll cycle back around to defend while I charge in. Getting that sort of team play going, I really like, so I'm hoping that you'll get into it a little bit and we can play.
So that's sort of the problem, is that when you play with random people, it's entirely hit and miss.
Absolutely.
Whereas if you actually set up teams with people you know, well, it turns out that most multiplayer games are better played with people you know.
Yeah. You knew. Mm. So I'll look into sorting out a headset for that and bugging you about it.
I need to make sure my headset works. I think I managed to change some settings on my computer, which disabled the microphone.
We can play without a headset. I mean, you know, I might get less annoyed at people that I play with.
if they're not in your ears.
Yeah. I used to play quite a bit with my nephew, but he's with the army now, and the internet on barracks isn't good enough. So
no.
So, yeah. The other video game that I've been playing quite a bit of is a mobile game, which is what you're currently tapping at.
Yes.
It's called Battle of Polytopia, or Battle for Polytopia on Android. I think it might be on iPhone. It's,
probably is.
It's a sort of combination of Civ and Age of Empires.
Yes.
You reckon?
I mean, it's mostly just Civ, really.
Oh, okay. It's been a while since I really played any Civ.
Age of Empire is real time.
Sure, yeah. Well, I mean, it is a turn-based thing. You play 30 turns and that's it. There is an endless mode where you basically play to extinction. But the 30-turn thing can be pretty good. You get like a score based on what you build and what you research and how much land you not only discover but then control as well. It's good fun. How on earth people on the high score list have like 130,000 points when the most I've ever got is like 19, I don't know. I only get 2 stars out of 3 when I play it because you need 50k to get 3 stars. So.
Yeah, that seems ambitious.
Yeah,
but
I did find myself looking at a wiki the other day, but then I thought, actually, I'm taking the fun out of it. Then
I did. I was looking up because I play a lot of Civilization. So I was like, oh, I should go and look at some strategy guys and play them some. Because I play up to Prince, King, something like that. And at that point, I was like, it's hit and miss if I can actually win. So I was like, I should go and look at some strategy guys. And I realised that it's probably more work than I want to put into it.
I think you probably have a similar thing to me where when I play, say, SimCity, I really enjoy the first few hours.
Yes.
And then it gets into the really, like, making things efficient in order to start moving to, like, a really high-level city. And I just go, oh, I just can't be arsed.
So I play the same game of Civilization a lot.
Yeah.
Where I start and then I play, like, the first couple of ages of it or something like that. And then I stop because now started taking a long time, or I need to go and do something else. And then 3 weeks later, when I come back, I go like, "Oh, I'm not gonna restart. I don't know what I was doing. Yeah, I'll start again."
This complicated machine where you're like, "Actually,
you start it up and you look at it and you click next turn and it stuff happens and you're like, I can't remember what I was doing. I think
that might be why Battle for Polytopia is scratching that itch for me, because 30 turns and you're done.
Yeah,
and honestly, the first sort of 10 to 15 go really fast because you only start with one dude and one city.
Yeah.
So there's only so much you can do, and there's only so many resources to generate each turn. But yeah, I've been enjoying it. I'll play a little more. You start with four factions. You have to buy the others, and until you buy them, you can't play against them, let alone actually control them. They're only about 60 pence each, though, so I might end up buying one. Or you have to buy one, and then you can play it multiplayer.
Okay.
So
that's nifty.
If you enjoy it, you could always buy one, and I could buy one, and then we can play against one another.
Okay.
And you'll probably destroy me every time. But, yeah. So that's what I've been playing. You've been playing...
Magic the Gathering Puzzle Quest.
Yes. No, I remember Puzzle Quest from... I think Xbox Live Arcade. I might have had the demo for it or something. It's pretty good. It's basically like a match three or more game plus deck building is what you describe.
Yes, basically.
Yeah.
And you get booster packs and there's various events, and just like Magic, you put limits on. Oh, you can only use cards from this set in this time, or you're not allowed to play with your black planeswalkers, which was really annoying.
Yeah.
So there's all sort of that kind of...
You better buy a different colour planeswalker
then. I have one of every colour.
Oh, well,
it's just that I haven't leveled up the others as much.
Yeah.
So there's that. And then, like, obviously, you can actually get a fairly large number of cards for free.
Okay.
But obviously, if you want to invest actual money in it, you can get more and better stuff.
Yeah.
I'm not doing that.
Standard, isn't it?
I'll play it for a bit. The interesting thing is, though, that you will never play head-to-head, as far as I can tell, against other players. You'll play against other players' decks.
It's a little bit like what I understand from Pokemon Go, where you don't actually play against a player, you play against their set of Pokemon or something like that. So they've built a deck, you play against it.
Okay.
Essentially what you're doing.
I didn't know that was the thing in Pokemon Go.
I think it is. I mean, they're finally allowing like trading and stuff like that, but I've never installed it.
We did it a bit initially, and then I decided that, you know what, I'd like some game in my actual game, so we stopped.
So, you know Graham, he's got Pokemon Go.
So ridiculous.
But he's bought a widget that I think it goes on his keyring or whatever.
It's dumb.
It effectively plays the game for him. It's like, oh, there's a Pokemon, you just caught it because... I don't know how the bloody game works.
Yeah, but you throw balls at him if you hit well enough. Then yeah.
So he's now at the point where he doesn't have to really play the game.
And at that point, you're just like, wait. So you're actively paying money to stop playing the game you want to play so you can play better? I don't understand.
It's funny.
But yeah.
Anyway. So yeah, I think that's all the video games we've been playing. We talked about Battletech a little bit, and you've completed Horizon Zero Dawn for the 14th time or something.
Yeah, something like that.
So I guess we should probably move on to the topic.
We actually had a topic to talk about.
Yeah, we've got a topic today, which, you know, I've probably got some thoughts on, but you've actually put together the stuff that
I've thought a bunch about it. It's basically victory conditions and time for miniature games. And it's mostly raised in relation to tournaments where timekeeping is actually important.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to talk about that, but I think we should take a quick break. I'm going to make a cup of tea.
Seems good.
It'll be that awkward message about me being the sponsor of the show.
Yeah.
And then we'll come back.
Seems good.
All right, see you in a minute.
Thank you to Mastercraft and Miniatures for sponsoring this podcast.
That's okay, mate. Mastercraft and Miniatures produce shoulder pads and hands for Space Marines, Japanese scenery, lanterns and so on, as well as some animals like tortoises and birds and toads and things like that. I also stock miniatures for Eden, which is a post-apocalyptic wasteland game. I also have some miniatures from Mal Miniatures and Golem Miniatures. Both really nice, but not for any particular game. You can find Mastercraft and Miniatures at mastercrafter.co.uk, at MC Minis on Twitter, and Mastercraft and Miniatures on Facebook and Instagram. We should also thank Narbacus for producing our intro and outro music. He's not anywhere on the internet, so you can't find him.
Right, so we are going to talk about winning games, okay. Basically.
So the method of
winning. Yes, the sort of metagame construct of how do you win,
okay,
and what does that mean for the game? As far as I can tell, there's three ways you can win most games. There's killing,
mm-hmm,
there's objectives, and that's time.
Okay.
Time is a factor in some games, but time can also just be turns.
So killing, we're talking about kill points in 40k, or likewise tabling people.
Yeah, like killing everything they've got. Especially like, did you kill everything? Some games have kill X model or X type of models, yeah, and then so you win.
War machine, caster kill.
Kill a caster, you win the game. Things like that. There's also, like in Bushido, you have, that sort of combines the kill with the objective, where some objectives are literally kill X type of model.
Yeah, so maybe, killing could be an objective.
Yes.
Or it could be a specific one. So like, yes, you say caster kill or killing a Vim in Bushido.
Yes.
But then there's the other side of objectives is will be your zone control.
For objectives you have like, so holding an area or zone or whatever is a fairly common objective.
Yeah, or turning something to be your,
yeah,
to belong to you.
Interacting with things like, yeah, doing a specific action. Bushido have some of that.
Mm-hmm.
I think Infinity has a bunch of that.
Okay.
I don't
know. Yes, because they have specialists interacting, yes, with stuff. Yes,
all sorts of things. And then you have further break it down to, can anyone do that? Or do you need special things?
Yeah.
Like War Machine have the various types of objectives, can only be held by certain types of troops.
Mm-hmm.
40k, I think, does the same thing with troops. You certainly used to. Things like that. Infinity, as you say, specialist needs to interact with things. But then you also, as a subsect of that, you have various games where you get to pick your objectives.
Yep.
Like,
yeah, so Eden can be asymmetrical, so you pick your own objective.
Malifaux does it.
Okay, yeah.
Dark Age, I believe, does it as well.
I don't know.
You make a deck of objectives, and then you draw one some every turn, I think.
Okay.
And so a large part of that is actually crafting the deck, because there's, I think you need 16.
Okay.
But there's more than 16 to choose from.
Okay. So, I mean, I played 40k a few weeks back, and we played with cards, which you drew a certain number, and you could spend a command point to get rid of them, and then the next time it came round to your turn, you could draw more.
Yeah.
And then you use those when you fulfill their requirements. So,
but I think where you can choose or where you can discard or get new ones, I think that is a specific subsect of objective games, because it actually changes what you want, especially if you have a wide choice, because some objectives you might not want to do based on the setting.
Oh, yeah, matchups can be quite important, but also layout of the board.
Or is the tournament setting or not?
Yeah.
Because the last one is time.
Does this objective require me to get to the last turn of the game?
Basically.
I'm not going to use it in a tournament setting.
Because you can't guarantee you'll get to the last turn.
Yeah. And equally, someone could prevent you getting that objective through slow playing you.
Yes.
If we're being cynical.
Yes. But, I mean, time itself can also be a victory condition. Like, War Machine does it a lot, where you are on a chess clock, effectively.
Guildball does this as well, doesn't it?
Guildball does it. There's a different War Machine, whereas in War Machine, once you run out of time, that's it, you lost.
Right, okay.
Guildball, once you run out of time, every subsequent activation you take, you only have a minute.
Okay.
And your opponent scores a point.
Right, so unless you're right on the cusp of victory, you're
going to win after you run out of time, but it's really going to be hard for you, because your opponent can effectively just back off, stop you from scoring more points, and he will win quite soon.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Because Guildball plays to 12 points.
Yeah.
So those two are quite different implementations of time, but not every game are very suitable to doing that kind of time. Mm. Like Malifaux or Bushido, because of the interactive
between players. Way too much you do in your opponent's turn.
Like, doing a chess clock just does not seem like a viable solution.
No, I definitely don't think it would work with Bushido.
You'd have to have very strict going, like, okay, you now roll your dice, switch it to your opponent, he then rolls his dice, pause, you now both reveal. And that just becomes unworkable.
Ridiculous, yeah.
And sort of defeats the whole point of having the chess clock anyway.
Mm. So, So winning, I mean, you've got winning games as killing time and objectives, but I suppose a lot of games rely on victory points for winning, and these are how you would score them.
I mean,
I'm not splitting hairs really, because what I'm going for is...
It's a relevant distinction.
Yeah, because some games, you just keep tallying victory points until you finish.
Yeah.
Other games, you can only get so many. So let's say 40k, you keep counting victory points, yep. and at the end of the game, who's got the most?
Yeah.
And things like, say, like I think the 4th edition Flames of War, 3rd edition, whichever one previous to the one that's out now, you had major victories, minor victories based on that.
Both Guild Ball and Malifaux has a set number of points.
Well, Guild Ball doesn't just have a set number of points. The game ends when you hit those points, not when you hit a number of turns.
Yeah.
Bushido, there's only ever 3 VPs available, but you may only score one of them between the two of you.
Yeah.
Even if you finish turn 6.
Yeah, because it's possible for no one to score. There's specific turns where there's a point up for grab, and if you don't fulfill the criteria for scoring it, you don't get it.
Yeah. So there's lots of different ways of implementing, or at least of counting the same sorts of
things. So I think I'm correct in the basic method there is of scoring the VPs. Various games will then have a slightly different implementation of what do you do with the VPs.
Yeah.
So I thought that's...
I wonder if some games also make VPs into almost like a resource.
Horse.
I don't know. Just, it could be quite an interesting mechanic to go, well, I am winning on VPs, but they're going to pull it back.
Yeah.
But I could spend a VP to do something.
I don't... Off the top of my head, I can't think of a game that does it.
But it seems quite...
I know War Machine does a slightly... different take on the VP. Do you have scenario points?
Yeah.
And if you are... I haven't played on any recent steamroller. Yeah. But I think basically if you are... It used to be you got to 5 points and you just won the game.
Okay.
War Machine is the game of the instant win conditions.
Yeah.
But it used to be... Now, I think if you get 6 more than your opponent, win the game.
Okay.
So you need to race ahead. You don't just need to be the first one who can get to 5.
Right.
But they've also capped the number of turns now.
Okay.
You can only play 7 turns.
I didn't realise there wasn't a cap before.
There wasn't. I mean, it mostly didn't matter. Apparently it does in the new one.
Okay.
Apparently, when they did it, you're like, oh, turn 7 almost never happens. That apparently is not true. But I haven't played competitive War Machine in ages.
This is the difficulty, is you kind of... There's so many games and it's tough to keep up with not even the meta, but just the way that the game is currently being run competitively.
Especially when some game changes quite a lot, quite often.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is increasingly a trend in games, I think, is that there's sort of living rule book style thing.
Yeah. There's this thing that I have where whenever you do a new edition, but even when you just bring out new models or new profiles or new upgrade cards, whatever, what you're doing is you're providing players with, or competitive players, with a new puzzle to figure out. How can I, to use a cynical term, how can I break this now? Well, how can I break this in a new way?
Totally what you do.
But that is what you do. I mean, the competitive scene of every game is a series of people breaking what is currently there.
Yeah, it's how can I make the best puzzle?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's playing tactically and playing strategically, but unless you're playing like chess or Go or something like that, there's an element of list building in everything.
Yeah.
And list building is about maximizing your exploitation of what's there.
Yeah, you want to it's where you give yourself tools
and hopefully it's something that surprises people,
or just something that's really good. Or you just doesn't have to be a surprise.
Something that people just can't deal with.
It can just be really good. And I mean, you in some games, well, most games actually, at a certain level it becomes a bit of a gear check. Can you deal with X? Oh, you can't. Okay, you're going to have a bad time today.
And it's equally where the top-level meta will emerge with a scene. So you will have, okay, so these things are, in casual play, broken as shit.
Yeah.
Like, if I turn up with this, like it used to be in 6th edition 40k, I'll rock up with this Death Star, and I'm just going to murder you.
Yeah.
You better win the roll-off for the first turn and damage my Death Star,
a lot.
Or I'm going to ruin you. But then the game becomes, well, all the top players have got one of those units.
Yeah.
So then it can start, in the worst case scenario, getting into rock, paper, scissors.
Yeah.
From a competitive point of view. But then the best case scenario is that you then get those players like...
Oh, I have a solution for this.
Outplaying one another. Or their list is written so that it has... Okay, maybe it has that Death Star, but then it has the depth, the redundancy.
Yeah, the backup. So my opponent can make sure he doesn't lose to this. Hmm. Okay. I have a plan B.
But I mean, this always makes like at least the first round of a tournament frustrating for people who aren't the top level competitive players.
Yeah, because sometimes you just run into stuff and you're like, so this was a bad hour and a half.
Yeah. And I mean, there's a whole discussion around this of why are all competitions, most competitions for miniature games, tournaments? Because then it makes it about what we're talking about now.
Yeah.
Which is off-putting to people who aren't prepared to compete at that level, who just don't want to or who aren't really able to.
Yeah.
Like, I'm too fascinated by thematic lists or just funny ideas. Like, oh, I want to take a Bushido Temple of Rokan list where everyone's an animal or a furry.
Yeah.
Like, that's ridiculous. It doesn't work very well, but it's funny.
Yeah, whereas...
Which means I'm not going
to
compete.
I don't really do themes. I mean, I'll pick a thing I want to do, and it might preclude me from taking the most powerful stuff, but I will definitely then try to go like, well, what is the best I can do with...
Yeah, how
like,
can I make that effect?
Like, I used to, back in the day, I played a Necromancer led Vampire Card Army in an edition where Necromancers were not nearly as good as Vampires. Okay, but...
But did you still go multiple small units and destroy everyone?
Of course I did.
So... I suppose, quickly, we're making sort of certain assumptions in this discussion that people know, for instance, what meta means.
Yes.
So I guess, quickly, we should define that in case anyone's looking at their podcast
and going delivery like, device. What are you talking about?
So it's basically
the community the game around, within the game. Yeah, the thinking in the community about how the game is played.
Yeah, it's not you need to roll this or that. It is...
What are you likely to see? How... Is the game played on the table? Like, you know, well, these kinds of things will happen, so I need to be prepared for that.
Yeah. And a meta is always emergent. It's rarely designed.
No, because it's really hard to actually take into account what people do with the game when you give it to them.
Yeah, you can only playtest something so much before it goes into the wild, and then in the wild it will be broken. It will be deconstructed.
Well, that, but also, your playtest group is, per necessity, going to be limited.
Yeah.
Those players will develop a meta of their own.
Mm-hmm.
That might not be, and probably isn't, the meta that will evolve once you give it to more people.
Yeah, so you have local metas.
Yeah.
It's interesting with Bushido how down in the south here, we have a very different meta compared to the people who are up in Manchester.
Yeah.
Who tend to be the guys who are winning the tournament.
Yeah.
Which
means they're doing it better than we are, but...
Yeah, yeah. But what's interesting is that then when we all come together... People go, huh, I hadn't thought of doing that.
Yeah.
And yes, when they might look at our lists and go, I wouldn't think of doing that because that's daft.
Yeah, but if you look at it and go like, why would you do that?
That's half the fun of us all coming together like that.
Interestingly, that kind of thing works best with small communities.
Yes.
Because once you reach a certain size of game, the meta doesn't become global, but it kind of does.
And that's where you get the concept of netlisting coming in, where people go, oh, well, I found this list that's done really well in a different tournament overseas. Yeah. I'm going to just buy it and bring it over here. But you've seen a lot in GW tournaments for years and years.
Yes, but that was also because it was so list-dependent.
Yeah, and had reached that critical mass of players as well.
But interesting, even with something like War Machine, which is also very list-dependent, you still have regional or at least continental differences. I know the Europeans and the Americans play quite different things.
Yeah, absolutely. The one that I've seen most clearly used as an example is Infinity, where the Europeans have far less terrain on it than the American boards. Which,
that's going to radically change what you want
to
use.
And of course, terrain is one of those things where you can give guidelines in a rule set, but it's very hard to enforce because... Unless you are selling terrain, and this might be where GW would like to go in some ways, is they go, this is this piece of terrain. It is this big. It has these rules. But it's very difficult to do in any other game. Well, they are, absolutely, with their woods and so on. But whenever you have anything which is modular, which GW still do modular terrain, then you can't do that so easily.
I mean, the way to do it is, especially when you're talking about a competitive scene, is you have a set of maps.
Hmm.
But I don't know of anyone who actually do that.
No.
Because it becomes logistically difficult for tournament organisers.
Yeah.
Oh, can I put out these 8 tables? Oh, I can't. Not Exactly. Well, I can't run a tournament.
The ones where it does work. X-Wing's been very popular, and of course it's just a bunch of asteroids and you each place them, that's really easy.
Yeah.
Pretty uninteresting from my point of view, to be honest. I enjoy the game, but that is just... There's not that much terrain in space. That's why we call it space. I think Eden has an interesting approach where you
take
scenery is worth a certain number of points based on how many cards it takes up on.
Yeah, it can be sort of a competitive aspect to the scenery placement.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've seen The Walking Dead assign points to buildings or trees or cars or whatever. But yeah.
And you have various... I know various games have experimented with, oh, you're playing this, you get to bring extra terrain.
Hmm.
Like Wood Elves for Wildlands has got to play some forest.
They still do, yeah. Still
okay,
I haven't played. I think Sylvaneth, whatever.
Yeah. Wood Elves.
So we sort of wildly digressed from...
Well, that's a surprise.
from the list that you've got here. So, I mean, we talked about how do you win games.
Mm.
And we very briefly broke out killing time and objectives. So I'm just going to sort of have a look down the list that you've written out. So with killing, we're talking about killing the most models or the most points worth of models. Specific targets and so you've written a good victory condition or a little lazy or old fashioned. I think you're right. I mean it
can definitely have its places, like, and this is something we talked about before, and I know we don't quite agree on this with things like the cast of Killing War Machine, whereas I know it's a mechanic you don't like.
I don't like it because the way that War Machine works, you build your machine and you press go. If you're playing someone who's not faced that very specific construction before, they might not know that you can turn this 11-inch threat range into a 21.5-inch threat range because of the combination of two models plus another which has done some kind of special ability. And, oh, well, we set our models up and I died at the beginning of their turn two.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
It's just not fun. When you're in the scene and you're competitive, it's fine.
Yes, and I think that's where it takes on a different aspect, that kind of thing, where, like, the kill instant victory condition thing, because then it becomes it's a way of coming back from a game where you're behind.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm gonna lose this on, my army's gonna disintegrate before his, he's gonna win on objectives. There's a Hail Mary
pass Hail Mary
way of winning the game. It probably won't work, but it's my best shot.
Yeah. I would like to believe that happens, and maybe it does. I don't know the scene. I don't really know the game anymore. Yeah. So yeah.
That was certainly when I played it, and from what I hear on podcast, that's mostly the way it's used, because going for assassinations is not a very consistent victory.
Yes.
Because it is...
Well, it comes down to the rolls.
It also becomes quite dice-dependent.
So much does, anyway.
And if you go for it, you probably need to overextend. So if you fail, you probably lose.
Mm. Yeah,
it does become a catch-up mechanic.
That's the thing, at the competitive level, or if you have established with some friends, your local group, your local meta, then it can work there because you know what your friend is bringing.
Yeah.
But if you start having random matchups down the club with someone, and you know who, you're not going to spend half an hour reading every card they've got at the beginning of the game.
No.
Because that's not why you're there. So that's sort of where my casual objection to it comes.
But there's definitely issues with, you just lost the game. You didn't see that, sorry.
So I think the lazy or old-fashioned argument with just killing people, just wiping them out.
Yeah, that's less the instant victory condition, more like you just line up and beat each other up.
Yeah, and if at any point you're trying to use your game to model a conflict or a clash or whatever, so Flames of War, for instance, in the previous edition, just killing your opponent's units, well, that's not how conflicts are won. Yet, you do want to be murdering people, but that's not the goal. The goal is forcing them back... To abandon
you're fighting them for reasons other than, oh, let's have a fight.
And this sort of brings us quite neatly on to objectives, in that objectives tend to be set up in a game to tie into that concept of a larger conflict, where you're trying to control these areas on the board because that's your territory control in this skirmish. which then means the next skirmish which happens, you have a foothold. Let's say you're holding this farmhouse, and now you have a strong point. And it's trying to build into a very short, very zoomed in part of a conflict, the bigger picture.
Yeah, it's also, and that's quite important in some games and less important in others, it's a way of forcing conflict.
Yes, absolutely.
Between the players, because otherwise you sort of run the risk of, okay, well, I'll deploy on my back line, you'll deploy on your back line. We'll now shoot at each other and just roll dice until one of us goes away.
Any edition of fantasy where someone took Gunline, Dwarves, or Empire? Skavens. Oh, I guess I walk towards you and you shoot me a lot, huh?
Mm.
Cool. That's going to be fun.
Yeah, so at that point it becomes, are your dice rolling good enough to stop me before I get to you? Oh, it was! Well, you win.
And in fact, other than target priority, which is the skill targets, it comes down to, have you written a good list, and rock, paper, scissors, is it going to beat yours?
Yeah.
Like, do my cannons outrange yours by 6 inches? Well, that's kind of a winner.
Yeah, so I'll start by shooting your cannon and...
Exactly. Yeah. So there's still a game there, but it perhaps is a bit dull.
Which is why you have things that try to encourage more stuff than that. It's, I think, from game manufacturers, it's also a way of trying to encourage variation.
Yeah.
Especially when you have, like, well, you can only do this objective with this type of troops. You can only do this objective with this other kind of troops, or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, 40K did it a bit when they realized that, oh, all the basic troops, no one wants to use them. We'll now force you to use them. Yeah, I think they would have been...
They're the only things which score objective sort of thing.
I think they would have been better off making the troops actually good. But
yeah, although there is an argument that if they go, well, they're the only ones that can hold objectives, you're making them good at holding objectives. Or, but I think the way it is now, and I may be wrong, is that if let's say you had a unit of elites on an objective, and I had a unit of troops, I win that tie because mine are troops.
Yeah.
And I see your point, like, why don't you just make the troops good?
Or, you don't even, like, good is perhaps the wrong word. Interesting enough that I want to use them.
Yeah. The trouble is, of course, with 40K, and this is a somewhat of a digression, but you have, let's say, the tactical squad of Space Marines.
Yeah.
Their strength is their versatility.
It's that you can do a bit of everything, which means that you don't want to use them in a game because you don't want to do a bit of everything. You want to do something specific.
You want to put the odd missile into a unit over there and maybe flame a unit 2 turns later over here.
Mm.
You want to put 4 las cannons into that thing over there.
So
and
it
you
dies.
Hit this other thing with an assault squad. You want a thing which does its job very well. I mean, that's maybe a wider problem in unit design and so on.
Well, it's sort of come up in most games I've played, I think, is that a wide range of abilities or utility at lots of different things, but not particularly well, is often ends up being priced quite high because you can obviously do lots of different things, but the actual utility in the game tends to be lower than just bringing a bunch of specialists.
Yeah. So, with objectives... some games are very objective based, but if you wipe your opponent out, if you table them, you will win.
Yes.
Regardless of what the objective situation was. What I find interesting about Bushido, and I understand there's an argument that's a bit artificial,
is that it doesn't work that way.
It doesn't work that way. If you wipe your opponent out, the game ends at the end of that turn. And if your opponent was winning one
he
VP to none, he still wins on the VPs. And I get that when people try and take the very logical route of, okay, so he turned that objective in turn 2 and he won that VP, but now he's not around, I can turn the other two and get those last two VPs because he's not there anymore. But whilst I agree it is somewhat artificial, I like that it means tabling people isn't your goal. Objectives are your goal.
It's not a victory condition to table your opponent.
Yeah, and the thing is, in game design, everything's an abstraction. So... if you say, okay, well, he scored that VP, but then I wiped him out, I should be able to score those VPs.
But you didn't.
Maybe in the situation you were in, the thing that they needed in the wider conflict was just to get that first VP, and they achieved it. And I quite like that.
Yeah.
It's apologetics, I know. I'm making an excuse for something which is a bit clumsy.
Yeah, and there's also game mechanic ways around that. You can kill your opponent down to one model, and then you can put a couple of models in contact with them and go like, okay, we fight until I use your action points. I just roll all my dice into defense. I will never kill you, but you will never do anything.
Yeah, which is fine. I think it's fine. Everything is an abstraction at some point.
And I mean, if you can, you can also look at it and you can go like, okay, well, if this is clearly going to be the way it plays out, I can't do anything more. Should we just call it and say, you get this?
Yes. That is, yeah, I mean, that's something we can talk about more in a bit, but if we have time.
Yeah.
This may end up turning into a two episode segment.
Well, I mean, we did spend quite a lot of time talking about something else.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. I might cut it into two different episodes and yeah, whatever, we'll see.
Makes sense.
So the other thing which occurs to me with objectives, which is interesting in small model count games or games where you basically take a unit out of its normal functions to interact with an objective. Yeah. So if you look, Bushido is always going to be a touchstone for me. So you look at objective interactions with Bushido.
Mm.
If you do that, you're not fighting.
Yes.
Now, if you're in a zone and you're trying to hold that zone, you can absolutely fight.
But it limits your mobility.
There's this subsection of objectives. Like, yes, zones will limit your mobility, but it's likely that that mobility, you're going to want to be in that zone.
Yeah.
Or a zone. So,
or in that general area anyway. Yeah. Maybe you have a ranged weapon, so it doesn't actually matter. That's...
But if you actually have to spend actions or an action interacting with an objective, you are going, I'm accepting that this model is going to lose its potency from combat or to support other models for this action or for this turn in order to get the VP. So that makes it really interesting. That's why you want to chuck a couple of cheat models in, because then they can do the objectives.
Yeah,
the problem is, they are then more vulnerable to being taken out.
The enemy beats stick, and yes, becomes an interesting,
I think the
interesting counterplay in that.
I think it'd be interesting to see. I'm struggling to think of there is one scenario with Bushido where there's a zone in the middle and then there's an objective for each player. And that is quite interesting because you've got the zone where it's like, well, you want to be in the zone.
Mm-hmm.
It's a small zone, so it is controlling your movement somewhat.
Yeah.
But then also you want to leave the zone to get to that juicy objective that your opponent can't leave.
Because you also need the objective to actually get a decent victory. I mean, Bushido does that more than most other games because there only is three victory points.
Yeah.
So you can't necessarily just, well, I can control the zone and at the end of the game I'm going to win. That's cool. Yeah. But if you want to win the tournament, you probably need to get at least two victory points and you probably want all three.
Yeah. I guess you could sort of try an extension of that. You're taking the model out because you've got down here, you know, can anyone do this objective or does it require specific models?
Mm.
If it requires a specific model, I think in Infinity, you have a specialist needs to interact with a thing. So that's why you take specialists in your
party. List. Yes, they also do maybe cool things.
As established, we don't know Infinity very well. But it could be interesting if you took like a War Machine model where, let's say, only your caster could interact with an objective.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that exists.
No, casters can interact with score, all of the different zones and flags.
Mm.
So they are more valuable as objective takers, because you can do everything.
Oh, okay, but other units can only do
so. So the way it's broken down is that there's rectangle and circular zones, and then there's flags. And infantry can score one type, warjacks and battle engines can score the other type of zone, and then flags can only be scored by solos.
Okay.
Except your warguard can do all of them, because they're the most important ones.
Okay, that is interesting, actually. I like that.
So if you've gone, oh, well, I have a jack list. Just jacks. Okay, but then there are things you cannot score.
So you're going to have to murder the things which can.
Well, I mean, you can also... You only score if there's no enemy troops in the zone. So you can just stick a couple of very resilient other type of models in there, and then you're like, well, you're not going to score it. I'm not going to either, but I don't need to.
Yeah.
I just need to stop you from doing it.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, interesting.
So that kind of thing works. It also goes along the encourage diversity route of you need different things to be able to do all of these, and sort of punishes massive outliers.
Yeah.
Which is probably a good use of an objective system.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, you without creating a rigid structure of list categories for list building, you are creating soft.
Yeah, you're creating incentives to do various things, which was one of my objections to the Old Force Organization chart in 40K, where it's like, you have to take two troops to start with. I mean, part of the reason why they introduced it, only troops can score, was because you do like, I'll play an Elder Army. Okay, I have to take two troop choices. Cool, here's five Guardians, now I'm having all of the fun stuff.
Yeah.
because you forced me to bring 10 guardians. Okay, cool.
What I find interesting is that a point system doesn't fix that.
Not really.
Which is interesting. I just...
I mean, you can make the mandatory choices expensive enough, I suppose, to where you have to... Well, I'm going to have to put points into them. You have to do things.
Well, what I was going to say...
But that's a really bad way of doing it.
If you make the elites...
Expensive?
Really expensive. But the trouble is, all you do is shift the meta. So yeah. People go, well, what's a really good troop choice? Okay, I'll take loads of those.
Yeah,
because you're always going to get people min-maxing.
Yeah.
And I guess that the Force Organization chart was designed to
force you to bring variety.
Yes, but keep the min-maxing within acceptable bounds. Limits.
Yes.
Until, of course, you go, well, you've taken a master of the Deathwing, and therefore you can take everything Terminators. And they're all troops, so they can get the objectives. And
yeah, the problem with that approach is then you start fiddling around with how the chart works or which unit fits in where, and suddenly you've sort of broken it yourself.
Yeah. Okay, so what else have we got under objectives?
Under objectives, it was more like, what kind of objectives do we actually like? Because there are some quite different ones. There's also, and this is probably my least favourite type of objective, I haven't quite talked to you about yet. It's the ones where you need to have done X thing by the end of the game or by a certain turn. We haven't really touched that. It's things like, I know Malifaux, you certainly used to have a bodyguard objective, where you score points per turn past turn X that your bodyguard model is alive. But that creates the issue of, well, what if you don't get to turn 6?
Yeah. Or this has been a problem with the Bushido tournaments I've attended.
Yeah.
Where I mean, look, I'm slow. But if my opponent's slow as well, we're not getting to turn 6.
You might get to turn 4.
Yeah, and a few of the scenarios require you scoring in turn 6. It might be turn 2, 4 and 6, or it might be 2, 4 and the last turn.
Yeah.
Could be 5. Could actually be 4 as well if you're in a tournament.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting situation. I think actually it ends up being 6 turns is probably too long at a tournament.
I think
playing
so.
Bushido.
Yeah.
And it may be true of other games as well.
Especially since Bushido action kind of starts in turn 1. You could probably do a 4-turn game.
I think it would be interesting to try Bushido as a 4-turn game where you score, turns 2, 3 and 4.
Yeah, I think that would be fine actually for that. But that then means back to the whole time element, which is mostly a factor in tournament play. Like, the limit on the logistics of we have to play X number of games in X time means that you have to make sure the game finishes on time.
Yeah.
Because at a friendly game, you could potentially just play however long you want. Yeah. That's a certain incentive to get things over and done with in a reasonable time as well, because by the 4th hour, you're probably done.
Yeah, we've all got to get home as well. Like, you know.
Yeah, but also it's like, do you really want to keep playing? Probably not.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is...
And then, it's a completely separate matter in terms of victory conditions as well. Draws. Do we like them?
Draws are problematic from a tournament bracketing point of view.
Yes.
Because too many draws can create a situation where there's just too many people in the middle ground.
Yeah.
But
I mean, you have some systems which can't produce a draw.
Yeah.
Guild Ball cannot produce a draw.
Yeah, because it is the person who scores the last point.
War Machine has a bunch of tiebreakers if no one has won.
Hmm.
So tournament-wise, that will also not produce a draw.
It's interesting because Bushido accepts a draw.
Yeah.
But there are actually, I mean, there's two different draws you can get in Bushido, a 0-0 and a 1-1.
Mm.
On a 0-0, you both score fewer points than you would on a 1-1.
Yeah, because no one has done anything.
Yeah, but because, yes, you score your tournament points based on the result.
Yeah.
And it's a bit like crushing victory, minor victory, you know, whatever. I don't know. I think draws are fine in games, like, absolutely. In tournaments, it's a different thing because you want to be able to differentiate. Ooh. The point of a tournament, theoretically, is to find a winner.
Yeah.
Is to find, within the time limit you have allocated, the best player from the people you've got there.
Yeah.
Whether it's best list writer, best
Yeah, I mean, tools, actually, I think for most people, the in-game, what tournaments are mostly about is getting to play a bunch of games of your preferred game in a day, and tournaments is a good way of doing that. But that, again, also comes back to you probably want them managed in a timely manner, because otherwise you might only get to play the one game.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is, especially if you travel, probably not what you were looking for.
No, I mean, again, at the recent Bushido tournament, I was kind of infuriated that I wasn't finishing games.
Yeah.
And I was trying. Like, it didn't happen on a couple of them. And obviously, you like to have a chat with your opponent.
Yeah. It's a social event.
Especially where we're talking about a small community, where it's, I want to say, friendlier. It's less cutthroat, probably. I mean, it's not... Okay, so you go to an X-Wing tournament.
Yeah.
And you're going to play as many games as they can cram into that day
as possible. A lot of games, as it turns out. Yeah.
And you will realistically find probably the best player on the day because you've played enough games.
Yes.
But a Bushido event, you're only going to get 4 games in.
At most.
On a day.
Maybe 3. Really.
Yeah, I think 4 is fine. But you look at Blood Bowl, how many are you going to fit on the day? 3, probably.
Yeah.
Maybe 4.
Trying to remember how many games we did a day when I last did a Blood Bowl tournament. I think last time we managed three. Which I actually won our last Blood Bowl tournament.
Oh, did you? Oh, it's so long ago. But this is the thing that. Because theoretically, and we're getting into tournament discussion here rather than games.
Yes, but the whole victory is mostly relevant for tournament games. So, there is an interesting dichotomy between, well, should all games do tournaments? Probably not. But it is the standard method for the community to arrange events.
Yes. I mean, win is an easy thing to recognise and therefore take it on to define the rest of the event. It also
provides an easy format for running an event. Yeah. You show up and play games. As a tournament, I don't have to do, like, a narrative and go, oh, and then this happened and it quickly becomes
more... I think more narrative events are more work for the organiser.
Much more work.
And I think, to a certain extent, they may attract fewer very competitive people, but only a tiny bit, because
even if it's a narrative event,
you're still going to have people who are like, I brought something because I want to win, because it turns out we're playing a game.
And in my experience, narrative events just attracts fewer people flat out.
Yeah, unfortunately.
It's hard to sell tickets for.
Yeah.
Can be, at least.
Which is very interesting, because all but one of the people who go to that event
are not going to win.
I'm not going to win. Like, okay, so you get the top three, and let's say the top three plus one or two, depending on how many people are there, are people who turn up and they would like to win it. And the more people you get, the more likely you are to have people who the reason they are going is to win.
The reason, or at least compete and do well.
Yeah. Well, yes.
I think there's a slight difference between those two, although it's probably splitting hairs and not particularly relevant.
Yeah. Which is, I think with small communities, you're less likely to find that guy who's like, I want to be known as the guy who is winning all the tournaments.
Yeah.
But in the last year, again, I'll talk about Bushido because it's what I know. We've seen Chris win the Masters for the 3rd year running?
I think so.
It might be running, or it might just be 3rd year total, 2 years running. Can't remember. But also, Colin won the tournament we had in Portsmouth, and then the tournament at BonesCon.
Yeah.
And he was in the final game of the Masters against Chris.
Yeah.
So those guys are both known as two of the top players in the UK.
The players to beat.
Yeah. But what I will say, I've only played Colin, I haven't played Chris, but I've spoken to Chris's opponents.
Yeah.
Both those guys have a reputation for being really nice and friendly in their games. They know what they're doing, they've written good lists, and they will execute them
well. That's been my experience with top players in basically every game I've played, is that the actual top players are really nice, laid-back people. Because they know what they're doing, they know they're good at it, and they've probably been good at it for a while.
So there's
less of a need to try and push it to try and win. I find it's more up and coming sort of middle tier players who can be an unpleasant experience, but where there can be more friction, because they might not quite be there, but they want to be.
Yeah, I mean, look, we've all had experiences at tournaments where
that wasn't
that guy's moving his things you know, maybe half as much again as they should be and stuff like that because you weren't paying
attention. And suddenly it's like, oh, I didn't realise that one was there.
Yeah. Or, you know, oh, I moved this guy. He surprises your model. Oh, no, my model could have seen him. Well, I've moved my model now, so I guess...
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure.
I can't even call a judge for this one.
Yeah, no. It was over here somewhere, and yeah.
And that comes out... I've played a couple of... Well, I played definitely one top-tier 40K guy back in the day.
Yeah.
We're talking maybe a while ago.
Yeah.
And he wasn't, like, super, super friendly, but what he was very clear about things before they were done. So I would go to do something, he'd go, hold on, what are you doing? It's like if you play a game of Blood Bowl, someone going, hold on, is that a blitz action, or are you moving, or is this a throw action? Because you're moving the model at the moment, and it's just a move.
Yeah.
Unless
you I mean, Blood Bowl also has to hold, you have to declare what you're doing before you actually start moving.
And I think there's a good rule of thumb with, say, Blood Bowl, is you go, well, everything's a move, until you do something which requires a roll or can't be taken back.
Because, because you, especially in Blood Bowl, because it's based on squares, you can just take it back.
Yeah. Well, if you move and you were thinking blitz, but you haven't said blitz, you move and then you need to make a dodge roll and like you fail it. I mean, this is actually a bad example because the turn ends, but you're there, you're making a roll at that point. If you pass that roll and then go, well, this was a blitz action.
Yeah.
Well, actually, no, it wasn't.
No, it wasn't. You didn't say it and you... But I mean, you could even extend it. You're like, okay, so you start moving, you take your dodge, you fail, but you use your dodge skill to reroll, and then you decide to stop your movement because it's not too risky.
Yeah.
Well, if you hadn't said it was a blitz action, you can do it with someone else. But if you have said it's a blitz action, sorry, it's now gone. So it is actually important to do those kinds of things.
One of those interesting like process things, or etiquette, I guess, is that I learned from that top 40K player was when you roll your dice, and 40K is quite a lot of dice. It's not like other games like Bushido or War Machine. You remove your failed rolls.
Yeah.
Don't pick up your successes because the...
Because then I can't... Then your opponent cannot check afterwards because you just have a handful of dice. The interesting thing
is that he was clearly used to playing people who were going for those top tables.
Yeah.
And there's an understanding that maybe that's where the... Oh, no, that was definitely six hits, not four. Because if I get six, then three of those are wounds.
Yeah.
On average.
Yeah.
And so that was an interesting etiquette thing where he's like, look, I don't think you're trying to do anything,
but please it is good etiquette. Please do this way.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. It's not something that's written into the rules, but it's a sort of emergent behaviour.
It's meta again, isn't it? It's like the expected behaviour around the
game. I think it's an emergent behaviour. It's a point of etiquette that comes up through the community. So, yeah.
Well, it's similar. Like any time you have contentious measurements, or especially once you start moving templates around and stuff, you should probably check with your opponent.
And of course, a template, or is that entirely underneath the template?
Oh god,
I don't know, because that template is placed in the middle of this 6-foot by 4-foot board, and neither of us are tall enough to get over it. Even me at 6'3",
Exactly. There are issues with that.
Well, that's why some games have just done away with them entirely, I guess. God, where are we?
We've sort of
talked around all sorts of things.
Yeah. I mean, that's a couple of things. Oh, going back to the whole time thing, and you might not reach the end. I saw an interesting idea about time. And this is not from a game.
Okay.
This is from a baking show on Netflix.
Of course. It's a game. If it's a is it a game show, effectively?
You win 10 grand.
No, it's a game.
I mean, it's $10,000, so not quite 10 grand pounds, but...
Well, yeah, with the exchange rate, it's not too far.
No, it's not. So
anyway.
So the way it works is you start with four teams, and you get... There are two challenges, and then that's the final.
Mm-hmm.
But crucially, you have... It's all on time, because it has to be.
Mm-hmm.
But so you start the timer at the beginning, and you do the first challenge, and then you call the judges over, and then you go on to do the second challenge. But the timer just continues. So round one ends when all four teams have done the first challenge, and then someone gets sent home and everyone else continues, and then someone gets sent home after the second one. Mm-hmm. But that's not the important bit for this, really. Bond mid is, so you have your timer. Any time you haven't used at the end of the first two challenges gets added to your time in the final.
Mm.
So if you were doing...
So it allows you to do a fancier thing in the final because you've got more
time. Because you've saved up time.
Yeah. But that means you're then risking in the qualifiers doing something less fancy and not...
Yes.
Or less complicated, whatever.
It's less time-consuming, yes. Yeah,
interesting.
So, I mean, it could be a little bit. But it could be an interesting thing in, like, a tournament where you go like, okay, well, you have X amount of time for the day. Or you have X amount of time for each game, but any time you don't spend, you can add that to later games. Like, logistically, it becomes quite difficult to manage in terms of round length.
Yeah.
And it even more rewards players who play fast, which is potentially also a problem. I play quite fast. So I'm quite fine.
Between encouraging everyone to play quickly, but also then you might start punishing people who are less able to play quickly.
Yeah.
For whatever reason. Some people might have a physical disability or difficulty which makes moving models hard. Some people might just...
Not play quickly,
yeah. And it's difficult. You want to encourage people to get on with the game.
Yeah.
Because if you cause your game not to end, and again, we go to Bushido, if that game would have been 3-0, but it ends at 1-0 because you took too long, you are having a significant effect on your opponent's outcome over the course of the day.
Yes.
It might be detrimental to his next opponent.
Yeah.
Let's say I played Chris Hales in the first round of a tournament and he 1-0'd me because we only got to turn 3 because he will then
face a different player.
Well, he's going to go... Yeah, exactly. He's going to play someone who came, like, who also got a 1-0.
Yeah.
But actually, he would have got 3-0 if we were realistic about it.
Yeah, if you'd played to the end of the game, he would have probably scored all 3 victory points. Yeah,
so his next game, he might just decimate that poor bloke.
Yeah.
And then suddenly he shoots all the way back up again. And so over the course of a day, it evens out for his score, but then his opponent...
Yeah, it has
a shitty game, because...
The fact that you didn't finish the game actually impacts on 3 other players.
Yeah. Which is a really interesting thing. And, you know, my experience is people are happy to go, you know what, I've got 1 model left, maybe 2.
It's clearly going to end like this, have it.
Yeah.
But that's etiquette again.
And it's a difficult one, because my approach to that etiquette is, I will always offer that. I'll say, look, realistically, and if someone goes, well, I think actually, rather than it being a 2-0, I think it would be a 3-0.
Yeah.
Well, maybe we have a little discussion about that then. Maybe we even throw a couple of rolls in, just as like, oh, let's sit. Well, yeah.
But, I mean, yeah. Yeah, you might roll, like, did you manage to kill me on the first attack? Okay, well, then it only becomes this.
Yeah. So I think it's possible to do some extrapolation through being reasonable with your opponent.
I had with me my list again when I was playing Ross's Ninja. We played 3 or 4 games in a row where I think we called it in turn 2.
Yeah.
Because it was like, well, this is clearly what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Like, the game will end like this. And turn 2 or 3.
To a certain extent, you might just be going through the motions at that point.
Yeah, and we were like, okay, well, the game will end like this. We can play for another hour, but it won't change the outcome.
Mm.
And so we just called it. And then, because we were doing some practice game for some of them, we just re-racked and played again.
Yeah, yeah.
At the tournament, we still called it. Because it was like, well, okay, well, this is what's going to happen.
Mm.
Shall we just finish early?
I think that sort of thing is quite rare in Bushido. I think if you get to the end of turn 3, you tend to be able to see roughly where things are going to go. You might not be able to say, like, oh, definitely this many VPs each.
Oh, he'd kill a bunch of my stuff at the tournament. It's like, okay, I cannot stop you now.
Yeah, well, for instance, if his ninjas just managed through some freak of rolling to take out, like, all your combat guys, and all you've got left is support and objective takers, good luck.
I had Tetsusu and a couple of people who were in no shape to fight his ninjas.
Mm.
So it's like, I can keep one zone. We've played the zone scenario. Yeah,
Tetsusu will have that zone.
I'm having this one zone, but I cannot stop you from claiming the other 2.
Yeah.
So, shall we finish early? Which is actually...
Because that's the trouble. Tetsusu can kill things, but he'll have to leave his zone to do it. Yeah, at which point, another ninja will just step into
And so I can have one of these 2 zones, but you're going to have the other 2, so it doesn't matter.
So we're really talking about a point in the game where you've run out of tools.
Yeah.
You don't have enough tools to execute any job, really, other than just holding a position.
Yeah. But that whole thing finishing early is another interesting aspect of the time, because if all your games go on time, even if you finish the game and score your points, mental fatigue is a thing.
Absolutely, yeah.
And having a list that plays quickly, means you have more of a break between rounds,
which
can be important in a long tournament.
Yeah.
And then we're back to the whole playing quickly is an advantage. Playing quickly is probably always an advantage.
Yeah. There's always going to be things which are an advantage which people aren't predisposed to being able to do.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just... We all have different mental capacities. We all have different...
Guessing distances used to be a thing in most games. It's thankfully not anymore. I'm reasonably good at it, but I don't think it's a particularly interesting skill.
But even down to the thing, if you go, okay, someone is working a job which requires, you know, a lot of hours a week from them.
Yeah.
And they've got three kids.
Yeah.
Are they going to be competing in a tournament against someone who, you know, let's say they don't currently have a job.
Yeah.
And have no children or no significant others. Or they do have a job, but maybe their job is selling games or something, where they can play that game all the time. There's always going to be some kind of disadvantage for someone.
I mean, time investment, just if nothing else, just in learning all the models and stuff is going to be important. So, I mean, that it's never going to be quite level.
You just don't want to punish people too much for stuff, but you want to encourage things. It's a very hard thing to balance.
Yeah, you want to encourage certain type of behaviour, but you don't want to punish people unreasonably.
Yeah. And the other side of it is you can go, okay, maybe even if you lose every game, hopefully we can make this game still fun when you lose a game.
Yes, that's a big difference between just losing and still having fun.
And the question is, how do you do that? Like, I wonder if in some ways...
It's also a mentality thing.
It absolutely is. But making people feel like, oh, your big guy, he just got killed.
Mm.
If you still have redundancies there, then you will enjoy the game still because you still see that you have agency.
I mean, I remember one of my most fun, interesting games of fantasy, I lost it in turn two.
Mm.
I was playing a Bretonian army using my Dark Elves with the dragon. Yeah, the dragon moved slightly too far.
I just misjudged it.
Got charged in turn two and killed. Clearly, I am not winning this game. I've just lost a quarter of my army, and the only thing that can realistically destroy a Lance of Knights.
Yeah.
The rest of the game was just, can I avoid getting wiped out?
Hmm.
I guess we had fun.
The other way that you can make it stay fun is by having a certain degree of swinginess in the roles. But the trouble is that can also have exactly the opposite effect.
Yeah.
So if I go in, I've got my big combat guy, and I go up against your little guy, and your little guy just murders my guy through a freak. I roll a double one, you roll a double six, it happens.
Yeah.
And I can feel like, I've just effectively lost the game
I did all of the right things, and the dice said no.
Yeah. So there isn't a solution for any of this. But it's interesting to think about.
Yeah.
Have we covered everything that we were sort of planning on covering?
I think, we've had a general... I mean, the idea was mostly just, like, talk about victory, various ways of winning, and what do we think, and how does that relate to the games we play?
Yeah. I think what I would like, if all three of our listeners might be interested in saying what, you know, if we've missed anything, or if they completely disagree with us on anything.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to hear from people.
Especially because people have quite different experiences with various games and their victory condition based on what do you play
and how we all enjoy games in slightly different ways and different events in different ways. So, it'd be interesting to hear some stuff from people.
Yeah,
so,
I mean, I like the puzzle. I like the mechanics of the game, and I like theme.
Mm.
But I'm not actually that bothered about it matching up to my game.
This is a slight digression, but I like theme which is apparent through the design of the game, the design of the miniatures, and the mechanics of the game. You very rarely will find me reading the background on the game.
No, at the moment, the games I'm playing Bushido and Guild Ball. I think I've said this before. I haven't read the background for you. No.
I did read the background for Bushido, which I quite enjoy, That was 3 years into me playing the game.
Yeah. And if I'm honest, I don't actually like the theme of either. I'm not particularly interested in football, and I'm not particularly interested in Japan.
Interesting.
So, but I like the games, and I like the people who play them locally.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm playing them. Like, they're good games, and there's good people to play. So that's why I'm doing it.
So what I would say is, anyone who's been listening to this...
and made it all the way to this.
Yeah, well done, first of all. I'm sorry. If you have any thoughts, then give us a shout. We're on Facebook. There's a thing at the end of the podcast telling you how to contact us. And tell us, like, you know, what you enjoy about playing games and what your thoughts are on, like, victory conditions and so on. I think that's probably it from us
for today. I think so.
We need to figure out what game we're going to play tonight, and maybe that'll give us something to talk about next time.
Probably will.
All right. So, yeah, thanks for joining us, and we'll talk at you again soon.
Hopefully.
Bye.
Bye. Find Robot Dice Explosion at robotdiceexplosion.com, at RDE_podcast at Twitter, and Robot Dice Explosion on Instagram.